tonight's I'm sure will be an amazing, fascinating talk and in conversation. Just to say that this new series, Architecture Asia, has come about not just from a love of people that I've met over the years who are interested in the notion of the city and the cities of the future, but cities on the move, as much as Asian cities like my own Hong Kong has been for the last 20 years. An incredible change and amazing architectural structures that 20 years ago one would not have seen in most parts of Southeast Asia. But I'm also somebody who is interested not in a nostalgia for the past, but looking back at the past, looking at legacies, looking at architects and designers and craftspeople who've made a difference to the world in which we live. We talk about cities, but without people, I don't think there would be cities. And without Betty Yao, I wouldn't have met Ruth Iris and tonight, which is a wonderful connection for me. So here we are in our house of Asia, which is a welcome to all of you. I'm so looking forward to tonight's talk. It's a meaningful journey that we both had from having our fathers who've taken us overseas. And here we are returning, like a sea turtle sometimes, we think about the idea of the journey from the past. So it gives me great pleasure to introduce us to Ruth Iverson-Rollett to talk about Iverson, architect of Pipa and modern Malay. Please welcome Ruth.
Thank I'm grateful to Asia House for allowing me to give my talk in this beautiful building. I have been busy writing a book about my father with the help of hundreds of photographs from my mother's albums, my father's letters to his mother when he first went east, his drawings from his book, The Unfinished, pages telling the story of our year that he gave to my mother each year for Christmas, and my mother's writing from her book, Never Another Moment. It's a tribute to the man who gave me life, the father I so adored and honored. I was born in Malaysia and have visited often. I have given talks about my father at Badan Laisan, the Heritage of Malaysia Trust, and to the Friends of the National Museum in Kuala Lumpur. The first talk was instigated by Datin Valerie Al-Bakri, whose daughter is here, and Rayleigh Jenkins, who I met here at Asia House when it was first opened 7 years ago. That was an evening hosted by the British Malaysian Society, and they suggested I come to Malaysia to give a talk about my father, the architect who had spent all his working life there. 2 years later, I gave another talk in Ipoh, my hometown, to the Perak Heritage Trust, and I was encouraged to write a book about my father and his work. It has taken 6 years of hard work and is now done. It was printed by Arika Books in Penang, and I went for the launch in March this year. A mini launch in Ipoh, then one in Ipoh, the mini launch in Penang, then one in Ipoh, my hometown, and finally the big one in Kuala Lumpur at the residence of the British High Commissioner. The residence was designed by Sahan's father, a well-known Malaysian architect. The High Commissioner is an Ipoh girl. Her father was in business in the same street where my father had his office. He was a Dutch burgher, and his wife, Chinese, Mrs. Yance, was a talented dress designer and made my wedding dress in 1962. I remember the little girl running around when I went to their house for fittings. The family moved to England when he retired and his daughters went to school here. She then joined the Foreign Office, And her first posting was to Islamabad, to my husband Philip's huge immigration section. So we met again. Since I came back to London, I had two launches, one held at the offices of the famous architect Sir Terry Farrell, who designed the MI6 building, Charing Cross Station, and so many other buildings in London. And I had a wonderful evening at the Malaysian High Commission last month. The High Commissioner is also an Ipoh boy. I have already tonight met some Ipoh people, and I really think that all the best people must come from Ipoh. I would like to show you a slideshow of photographs compiled by Arika Books, the publishers in Penang. They organized my launches in Malaysia. This is my father. He was Danish and went to Malaya in 1928 at the age of 22 to get away from troubled Europe. He joined his brother, who already had gone there in 1918 as a planter. They sailed on a Danish ship and arrived in Penang. Hey, that's funny, let's jump another, okay. This is a picture of my father standing with his car on Tumble Road, our road, in Ipoh, the pre-war houses. They've all been demolished. Many houses have been demolished because, like Pamela said, the progress of modern architecture gets rid of everything nice and gentle. Arriving in Malaya in 1928, the young Danish architect worked for Boutier & Edwards and Keyes & Dowdeswell before he moved to Malaya. Boutier & Edwards had offices in Singapore, Colombo and Penang, and offered the young architect his first job in the East, but he only stayed with them for a year before moving on to Keyes & Dowdeswell, a firm of architects from London. They taught him a lot, although he was not too keen on having to learn about Greek pillars and the English way of building houses. He considered it clumsy and more primitive than what he had learned at the Royal Academy in Copenhagen. He became a member of the Singapore Society of Architects and studied to also become a member of the Royal Institute of British Architects, RIBA. Whether he managed this, I do not know, as circumstances changed. The Great Depression took its toll on the firms as clients stopped payments, and the firm eventually had to leave Singapore in disgrace after the Board of Architects had found it guilty of professional misconduct. It was my father's luck. He took over the Ipoh business in 1934, and that was to be where his main office was for the rest of his working life. The firm was B.M. Iverson. Architect Ipoh. When he first arrived in Malaya, he wrote enthusiastic letters to his mother, and this is a sketch sent to her of his impression of the lime rocks of the Kinta Valley surrounding Ipoh. One third of the world's tin was mined in the Kinta Valley in those days, and the fertile land was ideal for the production of rubber. Today, the faithful rubber tree was first introduced to Malaya by Sir Henry Nicholas Ridley, when he brought a gum nut from Kew Gardens to the Singapore Botanic Gardens. Tin and rubber made Ipoh a very rich town. And once again, my father was lucky to be there at the right time. He was sent to Ipoh to supervise the construction of the grandstand by the Pierre Turf Club and drew a sketch for his mother. And this is the completed grandstand, designed by Keyes & Dowdeswell. He went to supervise the buildings of the Burma Road housing scheme in Penang, in a part of town that was designated a residential area. I visited recently and it is beautifully maintained. The estate was commissioned by a Singapore-based contractor and granite supplier. Lam Lu King Building. Lam Lu King was a Cantonese businessman who had established himself as a tin miner in Kampar in the state of Perak and was a property owner in Ipoh. This is a sketch of the original drawing with oriental embellishments, as suggested by Keyes and Dowd's will, which my father sent to his mother. And this is the modified building that he built. While still working for Keyes and Dowd's will, but in charge of the Ipoh office, he managed to get the job for 150,000 straight dollars with a promise to complete it in 6 months. And that was done in those days. The staircase. He was met my mother and was married at the Presbyterian Church in Belay in 1938. His clients from his time with Keats and Dowd's will liked his work so much, they continued to give him more work. On his own, he designed Fair Park in Ipoh, 40 terrace or attached houses built for Lok and Yat in 1937. They were good quality houses for the rising middle class, but they too, alas, have been demolished within the last few years. The house on Tamil Road. He designed a house for his brother, who was manager of Lima Blas Estate, owned by Sok Finn. The top of a small hill was levelled to build the residence. Philip and I spent the night there some years ago, and it was magical, with jungle growing all around and a view over the whole estate. Several clients wanted houses in the Cameron Highlands. A plateau in Pahang, where the air was cool and you could escape the grueling heat of the valley. In the pre-war days, when Europeans only had leave every 4 or more years, it was essential for them to enjoy the cool air, the peace and beauty, the fireplaces and chimneys, and beautiful English gardens. This is one of the more modern houses that he designed, the White House in Cameron Highlands, built for S.F. Smith, managing director of Sime Darby, who retired in 1951. The house is still there, beautifully maintained, and as most of his houses. He designed many cinemas and entertainment parks for the Shaw brothers. Two of the four brothers, the Rung Me and Rung Rung, arrived in Singapore and opened cinemas. And my father was a favourite with them and built many. All in all, between the Shaw brothers and Cathay organisation, he built 38 cinemas all over the country. This is the Jubilee Cabaret in Ipoh for the Shaw brothers. And this is a drawing by Lutt, Dato' Muhammad Nurkhamid, another Ipoh boy, and Malaysia's answer to Jarvis. I sent him my book and his thank you letter. He told me how he admired my father's drawings and would treasure the book forever. This is one of my father's drawings. As the architect was building a sanatorium for the Australian Red Cross in the hills, he built a small house for himself and was going to move up there with the family. But shortly before it was ready and the paint dry, the Japanese arrived and the house was burned down. They had to flee and leave all their possessions behind. All European volunteers had to register to do their duty. The women were called up to do Red Cross training and look after the post where the men were staying. My father wanted to do something but was not wanted because of his foot. He had had a bad accident some years earlier and his broken ankle had not healed properly, which resulted in having to use a stick. Others volunteered to join the army. He tried to, but he was a cripple who walked with 2 sticks. He tried to get a job as a driver or anything that could be done with his bad foot, but he was turned down. That was our luck, and the whole family left Singapore for Australia the week before Singapore fell. We spent 4 years in Melbourne. Shortly after we arrived, my father contacted the Australian Red Cross in connection with the hospital he was building for them in the Cameron Islands. He was able to give them all sorts of details and figures, and in the course of the meetings, he mentioned our anxiety about our families at home. In 1943, he helped us to send 25 words to my Dutch grandparents through the Swiss Red Cross and received an answer. They were all well and all had survived the war. In Melbourne, my father worked as a draftsman for a private firm to start with, but soon got a job at the Australian Architectural Department, where he designed a new town to be built when the war was over. He travelled to various towns in Victoria and New South Wales with the plans and gave lectures. Finally, he got the chance to go to Morocco, New Guinea. He was sent there by the Dutch. My mother was Dutch. Not much was left standing after Japanese had been, but it was the last place in the East where the Dutch flag still flew. He felt it was the first step back to Malaya, and looked a bit like Livingston, as there were no bricks available for the barracks and the hospital he was to build. He used empty beer bottles, and there were plenty of them, thanks to the army. My mother joined the Dutch Navy and was PA to the Admiral. As soon as possible at the end of the Pacific War, he returned to Ypres to see how he could restart his business. His old office had been burned down and everything was lost. His house had been used by the Kempetai as a torture chamber and the contents looted. So he moved into the Eastern Hotel that he had designed before the war. He opened his office in the hotel in very primitive conditions. You could see his bedroom, and on the other side of the partition was the drawing, was the office. And soon it went well. The wife and the children arrived from Australia on the crowded ship, the Tasman, and they were all seasick. And then they all travelled home and leave in Europe. On the good ship, the Zeelandia, known as the Terror of the Red Sea, although it took 2 months from Penang to Rotterdam. My father had not been home for 18 years, my mother 12. My mother's great friend and partner was the Dutch architect, Henk van Citroen, here with my mother. Henk and he had been friends when working for the same firm in Singapore. Henk was taken prisoner of war and sent to Japan, where he, with his artistic skills, was forced to work as a tailor. He somehow managed to make his way back to Holland after the war, and my parents found him semi-paralyzed, down and out, and living in borrowed clothes. They brought him back to Ypres, where he joined the firm that had grown and became known as Iversen van Citroen, Ypres, Penang, and Kuala Lumpur. My father was also a talented painter, and this is a view of our garden in Ypres. My father was very ill, so my mother stepped in and did the supervising of the buildings. And this is supervising the piling of a new house in Tillagansen, slightly different from what our son today. Here he's working at his desk, always with a cigarette in his mouth. And here he is building a fountain made of iron-rich rocks for a wealthy tin miner. This is in front of his office in Penang, and at Atatürk'ün at the Lone Pine, a very famous hotel for everyone in Penang. He built houses in Penang, Baba Zur, a London-based trading company, established in Penang in 1865. Still there, still beautiful. And I go and have tea with the owner every time I'm there. This Dr. Young's house in Penang, now also gone. This is the childhood home of the famous Malaysian architect Dato' Ken Young. This is the Chinese swimming club. where I had dinner in March and met two of my father's apprentices. They told me what a great man he was, strict but very fair. This is the Lo Kyu building in KL. Lo Kyu was a Chinese born of Cantonese descent and a business magnate. He was a famous philanthropist in British Malaya. His one son, Lo Kuan To, along with his fourth wife, Lim Cheng Kim, established Associated Theatres Limited, later renamed the Cathay Organisation. The other brother was Lo Kuan Yat, who was a property magnate in Ipoh in the good times. This is Federal House in Kuala Lumpur. He won the first prize in a competition for the Post Office Savings Bank in 1954, later renamed Federal House with its government offices that are still there. He was ill in Denmark and had a kidney removed. When he learned that he had won, my mother fainted. You see the drawing there. I visited in March, still there, and beautifully maintained, but dwarfed by its neighbour, the Petronas Towers. Then it was the tallest building in KL, six stories high. The newspaper articles wrote, Everson has won the most important architectural competition to be held during the pre-Medeca period. And a well-known Asian architect praised it as the best early example of the international style of architecture in Malaysia. It has now been listed, thank goodness, because they seem to demolish everything they can see. The British High Commissioner, Sir Donald McGilvery, officiated the opening in July 1954, and my father stands behind him. It's the staircase. Looks exactly the same. Then in Ipoh, the Veterinary Research Institute, Center in Ipoh, still beautiful and in full working order. The Japanese have a very great, they're part owners of it, and it sends its medicine all over the world. The total cost for the entire complex, including offices and staff quarters, was $900,000 then, and a grant of £94,000, about $2.5 million in today's money, was provided by the British government under the Colonial Development and Welfare Act of 1945. The foundation stone was laid by the Sultan of Iraq. Next, he designed the Geological Survey Federal Headquarters and Senior Staff Quarters, a project that cost $1 million straight dollars. It was to incorporate a geological museum telling the story of the mineral-rich state, Perak. The name of the state means silver, and apart from tin, silver, and gold, other minerals are found in the soil. The museum is still one of the few attractions Ipoh can offer tourists as cultures. This is one of the drawings from the unfinished, cleverly manipulated by my wonderful graphic designer and planning, and used to make the cover of the book. See Denmark House, houses, churches, cinemas, everything. This is a cinema in Penang, still there. It didn't look quite as gaudy in his day. This is the Lido Cinema in Ipoh, where I have spent many evenings. Several of the many cinemas he built have burnt down in a mysterious manner. Others are used as furniture stores, and I often ask, how much furniture do people need in the museum? These are the offices. Business had grown with offices in Ipoh, Penang, Kuala Lumpur, and later in Singapore. And like his father, Pia, my brother, became an architect. And after my father's retirement in 1966, he took over the business in Ipoh. But things were not easy in newly independent Malaysia, and he moved to the office in Singapore before returning to Denmark after 3 years. The firm was responsible for the design of thousands of buildings in Penang, Perak, Cameron Highlands, Kuala Lumpur, and Singapore, and all over the country. Before my father finally departed, he hired a car and drove all through Malaysia to say farewell to every nook and cranny. It was hard to have to say goodbye to the country we all loved, the country my brother and I were born in and had lived and worked in for so many years. Each time I go back, and that's often, I'm delighted to see so many of his buildings still standing proudly and still as modern and beautiful as the day they were built, the monuments to a great man, architect and father. And this is a photograph of the Iverson family. My brother and his wife, both architects, my mother and my father, my little son and my nephew, Nix. Sadly, only the three in the front row and I are the ones that still alive. This is a photograph that was taken in 2013 at the Mahatma Gandhi Kalasali Tamil School in Sungai Sibut, which was declared open by Vijaya Lakshmi, sister of the Indian Prime Minister Pandit Nehru, the first female president of the United Nations General Assembly. They did not know I was coming, so they hadn't just quickly hung the picture up there on the wall. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Ruth, for that insightful introduction and context for your father's work in relation to your own family life and growing up and born and growing up in Malaysia. But perhaps we can give a slightly broader context to the era in which your father was born and kind of rewind the story a little bit back to 1906 in Denmark, and the capital city is the same year saw, I believe, the first flight in Copenhagen in Europe by the Danish inventor and aviator Jacob Ellert Hammer. It was also the year that the oldest film production company in the world originated in Copenhagen, the Nordisk film industry. And in terms of architecture and housing, this is a very fascinating trivia thing, but amazing. In terms of utilities, 20,000 bathtubs with hot water and 50,000 flush toilets were installed in homes around the time your father was born.
Goodness.
And apparently, the first bicycle paths around the lakes was when your father was 7. Mm-hmm. And after that, the much beloved sculptor, as we all know, The Little Mermaid, by Edvard Eriksson, was unveiled. So did your father ever talk about his childhood?
Oh, yes. He talked about his childhood. He came from a very, very fascinating family. His father owned a school and was a school teacher, a Latin history teacher. And they put on plays and it was just very, very fantastic. My grandfather was very talented. He wrote poetry, he played the piano. He was a highly intelligent man. My grandmother was clever with her hands. She could do anything. Mm-hmm. She cut wood. She painted. She did everything. And she was a suffragette.
Wow. Great good timing.
And her sister was the leading suffragette in Copenhagen. And I'm very proud of that.
I think that's a bonus.
And they wanted, because it was such an artistic family, they wanted my father to be an artist. Uh-huh. So they named him Bertel. And Denmark's greatest sculptor was Bertel Thorvaldsen. Mm. So my father was called Bertel, and it worked. Mm. He became an artist.
But in terms of your paternal family name, Iversen, correct? I read that its roots are Eve, Old Norse for a bow or a yew tree, so it's got lots of sort of roots and stability, and R, Iver, is warrior or a spear. So you've got some strong characteristics in your family name, your father's side. Do you think those are things that have given you strength over the years to be that sort of fearless,
I'm sure. It was warrior. A very strong-willed and busy, energetic family.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
And so your father's elder brother, you mentioned earlier, Werner, was already in Malaya in 1918, and a successful planter. Do you think that's part of the reason your father decided to go to Malaysia initially? Did he talk about why he joined his brother or went there?
Well, I think everybody who lived in Denmark just wanted to get out. It was cold, it was wet, and times were difficult. My grandfather had recently died, and I think my father was offered the chance to go to the Far East.
Mm-hmm.
And of course my uncle would have told about Malaya. And Malaya, whether you've been there or not, is paradise on earth.
Mm.
So
in those days, how long did you think correspondence, letters, or were there sort of telegrams and things like that?
He wrote in the book I'd written, in one of the letters he had written to his mother, he said, it only takes 28 days for a letter to get out.
I think we could all have that sort of de-linking from time to time. But 28 days, give us a bit of space to think and to contemplate. But wonderful, the letter writing, as well as the illustrations, which we'll come back to. But let's come to you now, because obviously you were born there 10 years after your father arrived. Is that more or less the time after he arrived there? And in Batu Gajah.
Batu Gajah, which means elephant foot.
Elephant foot hospital, which is in a city in Perak, about 24 kilometres from Ipoh, which obviously became your home. And I wasn't familiar with the word Ipoh, meaning, again, a tree, apparently. So
poisonous tree.
Poisonous tree, yes. Darts, I believe, were made for
the Aborigines. Use the poison from the tree for their darts.
Right. But I like the tree metaphor that's coming out, the family name, you know, where you were, where you grew up. And so let's look at a little bit of the branches of your life tree, because we all know the expression, home is where the heart is. And I recall you mentioning this in an interview. You said you remember everything about Ipoh from your childhood, the smells, the food, your home. So tell us a little bit more. Is it the smell that gets you first, or is it a memory that's triggered by something from your childhood?
I think if you are from Ipoh, it must be the smells of the food.
Mm-hmm.
Because if anybody says they are from Ipoh, the first thing people say, the food. It's famous for its food, yes?
Yes, anybody give us some examples?
There are so many smells, some not so pleasant either, but they're the smells of home. Like the drains. Christian wouldn't know because he lives in Singapore.
And maybe the tastes as well.
Everything is just fantastic.
Yeah,
and the friendliness and the love.
Mm-hmm.
It's just lovely.
And let's just ask you about this idea of your transnational existence, because you said your first language is English, your second language Malay, third language Dutch, which you learnt when you were 8. But how do you feel this has affected your sort of switching between identities, places?
Where I don't think it affected me at all. It was just normal.
Mm-hmm.
We used all four languages all the time.
You didn't get confused at all?
Never.
Amazing. Really? Okay. But did you dream in any other languages?
Yeah. I don't know.
Right. I believe Ipoh was also, you mentioned mining or silver, a mining town. At one point was the centre of the world's tin industry.
Yeah.
Things began to change in terms of scale when another European architect, who's somebody I also hadn't realised, who was a military figure, Arthur Benison, is it Hubbuck? Does anybody know Hubbuck? H-U-B-B-A-C-K?
Yes,
apparently he arrived and created the courthouse in Ipoh in 1928, the year your father arrived.
Ipoh has a lot of very, very striking colonial houses,
mm-hmm.
which are very well maintained. But to me, I think that the international style is just as important to keep for their heritage.
Mm-hmm.
These white houses have built, the station, the courthouse, the post office, are splendid. But so are so many other places.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps that's interesting because it's also the fact that the town, or as it became a city, also emerged and developed through a hacker miner turned millionaire, Yao Tetshin.
Yes.
Apparently he came and started in the 1930s to build something called the New Town section,
yes,
of the Eastern Bank. So was there a sense of the old and the new, both in terms of, as you mentioned just now, architectural,
yes,
styles? And would you say, as even your father's own design varied and adapted over that
I
period?
Because I think that in those days, A, you had enough land for the town to expand,
mm-hmm,
so you didn't have to demolish and build new. That's what they do now. They're tearing down all the old houses, and then they're building modern glass houses instead, which is terrible.
Mm.
But in those days, there was room enough for the town to expand and not build modern building. I mean, and my father built a lot of shop houses in Ipoh too, but they were all kept to the same level.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't suddenly have a 25-story building in a street where there was only two floors.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what's ruining the town now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, maybe we can come back to more detail, but I'm also interested in something you said earlier about the sort of slow development, or you mentioned tourism. There wasn't that much to see in those days. But I believe that the state of Perak is trying to get Ipoh listed as a World Heritage Site. And I don't know if...
No hope in hell.
No. All right, but I heard that it has its own Ipoh wood, Hollywood-style letters now on the hillside by the Plus Expressway.
Oh, but it's been there for ages.
Hollywood on each Ipoh wood.
Yeah,
you've seen those.
Before,
But for those of you interested in how much money was spent on each letter, 100,000 RM on one letter each, so 800,000 to spell out Ipoh on the hillside. And I'm interested in the idea that we are now seeing over 40 years of Malaysia. Your father designed many landmark buildings, as you mentioned, the Federal House and Kuala Lumpur. And it was the winning selection, you said, of an architectural competition. But up until 1951, were you aware of your father's position and contribution to the building of the city? I mean, was it sort of in the air that you knew his importance, or was he just dad and...
He was just dad.
...did what he did?
He was just dad. I knew he had designed cinemas. When we went to the cinemas, I would know that he...
You loved that, did you?
Yeah.
Cinema.
And we used to go in the evenings. We would go for drives, because he would go and supervise all his buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So we would go with him to supervise the buildings.
Mm-hmm.
So I've grown up with the smell of newly built houses.
And going around with him.
And going around with him.
Well, that's interesting, because you showed an image of your mother, so let's turn to her for a while. You said she was supervising another when your father wasn't very well. But in general terms, I mean, how did you feel her impact was as her role in the local community and on the family? I mean, was she very active all the time, or did she take a sort of, not a second seat, but was she somebody who allowed your father to, you know, live his life, and she was there because she wanted to be? Or?
It was the most fantastic marriage, and she was his support all through life.
Mm-hmm.
And she was just great. And she, no, it was just a very happy marriage, and she supported him every way.
Mm-hmm.
Having been, she was a contractor's daughter, so she had grown up with buildings too.
Oh, right.
So it was in her blood.
Mm-hmm. You think it is in the blood, then?
Yes,
you feel
I think so.
Yes. Well, that's interesting, because thinking of in the blood and where one resides, I'm also thinking of the culture of being an insider or an outsider, a local or an expat. Unlike myself, who came to Hong Kong when I was very young, you obviously were born there. Was there a sensibility that you're local no matter what, or is there a idea that comes over time of being accepted as local?
I'd never even thought of it. I was just part of Ipoh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were totally accepted. We spoke the language. We had friends of every race. And we were just... Ipoh was a very small but incredibly friendly town.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Would you say it was cosmopolitan in those days? Or really?
In those days, because so many European firms had their offices there,
mm-hmm,
and I see several people who were working there when I was there. So it was cosmopolitan.
Yes. I also heard about someone called Commander Ian Anderson, who played a great part in,
yes,
Ipoh as someone behind the Tembe schools,
yes,
ipohworld.org, Apparently he was dedicated as well to the history. Did your family know him or of him?
He's a great friend. I write to him nearly every day.
Really?
He is a Scottish commander who has retired to Ypres with his Chinese wife, and he does everything possible to maintain the heritage of Ypres. And he has just opened a Hakka tin miners club, which he has restored, and that's one of the few museums, apart from the Geological Museum, Ypres can offer tourists.
I see.
So I said there are two things worth watching and seeing in Ypres.
Thank you. Well, that's quite timely, because heritage is vital in terms of what we're looking at. As you mentioned earlier, you love Ypres very much, and it's really where your heart is. But you said you've despaired when you see what's being done to it. You're horrified at the destruction of the buildings, you've called them modern monstrosities, without any merit, that replace the beautiful homes, not just that your father built and have been destroyed, but just a lot of heritage buildings that made it so special. What do you feel, what have you done, because you've done so much to put this book together and everything, but are you active in the sense of what you want to have done there? Is there a voice, a platform to help save buildings in Ypres?
I can't, because I'm the wrong colour.
Oh, I see. So it's a sensitivity, then, towards heritage.
I just don't think that people recognise it and realise how important it is. They just want everything to look like modern Shanghai.
Yes.
You know, it's just so tragic.
Mm. Well, that's interesting you mentioned Shanghai, because I was there in 1997, when the Bund and the Pudong district were really, the Pudong district was just about emerging. They already had the radio tower, but they didn't have the Grand Hyatt in those days. And I remember being invited by the Shanghai Sculpture Committee to make recommendations how they could put, you know, new sculpture along the bank of the river. And one of the officials said, "You know what I would really love? Is a replica of the Little Mermaid put in Shanghai on the riverbank." And I was thinking, well, how interesting. He said, and then the Eiffel Tower. I said, okay.
He said, Las Vegas.
And then, yes, he said, Rodin's Thinker. So I think he was thinking of all of these wonderful Western iconic sculptures that we could put on pedestals. And I was the only member of the group, including, I don't know if any of you know, Christo and Jean-Claude,
yes.
who do covering large monuments. And I said, I'm sure Shanghai has really interesting sculptures that can bring something new rather than just replicate Western artefacts. And I was told that that was rather impolite of me to say that in a gathering. But I actually thought, well, I'm here, they've invited me. One should contribute. You know, we don't want replicas anywhere anymore. We've got too much of the notion of the repeated elements. And I think in architecture, I grew up in an era where postmodernism was a term that we used for the kind of eclectic style where you add a bit of, you mentioned your father about, you know, columns. But and in fact, Terry Farrell was conceived as a postmodern architecture. But I think, because I was from Hong Kong, he did the British Council offices there, which I thought were fantastic. So I really love the idea that we can borrow from different times and places. But did your father have a style that you really returned to, or you felt was certain elements that's... Like we could talk about Corbusier having stilts and having a kind of ship-like structure. Did your father go back to any particular forms that were interesting?
I just think he did all sorts of things. And he would ask his customers what they wanted and give them more or less what they asked for, mm-hmm. but quite.
Yeah, I guess it's important with architects. They have to take on as one...
But he certainly, he was influenced by his Danish and the Dutch roots.
Mm.
And he was very influenced by Frank Lloyd Wright.
That's interesting.
But talking about the Little Mermaid, when they had the World Exhibition in Shanghai some years ago, they borrowed the Little Mermaid. She was sent out. To Shanghai in the pavilion, and they even brought water from Denmark.
How amazing.
I'm proud of being Danish, but not in this case.
Yeah, Yes, but you talked about Las Vegas. I was thinking the same about Macau, because as one of my nearest and dearest places to visit, I was shocked at how much like it, the Sands casino, it's like a strange amalgamation of something surreal, I mean, in terms of architectural form. But let's, because time is of the essence and I'd really love people to contribute, let's just turn, obviously, to the book, turn some of the pages of the book. And compiling this has been a very personal journey for you and for, you say, many of us, and looking through family albums, archival material. When did you first decide that you really wanted to put this together? Was there a moment where you thought, look at all this, there must be something, I must do it myself? Or
I went to Ypres, I think it was in 2009, and I have a very good friend there called Hong, and he had arranged for me to get, he was the chairman of the Pera Heritage Society, and he had arranged for me a group of architects, art historians, and my publisher, Salma, to come to Ypres for a long weekend and have a brainstorming meeting to see what we could do to maintain my father's buildings, to see to it that they weren't all demolished. Mm-hmm. And Salma, when she saw my father's drawings, she said, I want to publish a book for you. So that's when I started putting it all together. I got all my mother's albums with all my father's buildings, and I put them in order. I had all her letters, all her memoirs. My mother was a very good writer, and I had my father's letters to his mother. And I just thought this was great. So, cracking.
Fantastic. And also thinking about, let's just go a little bit back to the content of the book, because you've got these wonderful illustrations, as well as fantastic archival photographs. But I'm also interested in, like Hong Kong, Ypres has appeared to be a city of disappearance. How were you when you saw some of the images of, as you said, these really fresh-looking buildings that have hardly changed, and then they're just erased? I mean, was it quite heart-wrenching to see?
Breaks my heart, yes, absolutely.
I wondered about that, yeah. And also the sense of return to the past of places that we no longer see. I mean, for example, my former home in the mid-levels of Hong Kong, my school in Kowloon, some of the streets have disappeared, some of the old areas. Where you mentioned earlier about the restaurants and the, what we call diaper dongs, it just seems a shame to me. Do you feel, having reflected now, and the book is here, do you think this is a really important reference tool for the future, for people to look at a sort of social documentary of a city that you loved and grew up
in? If people in Ypres would buy the book, but it's difficult enough to find a bookshop.
Really? Well, maybe someone can help in the audience to ask around. Well, I'm just coming to a close then, recalling reading some of the old houses in the city were used for director Ang Lee's Shanghai movie, Lust Caution. I hadn't realised that was also in Ypres. And he's quoted as saying that probably the only place left that he could make a movie in these old houses are now all gone. So that seems quite sad to me.
Not quite.
No.
But, I mean, for instance, talking about films, there's Indian Summer, which was shown last year.
Oh, yes.
That is supposed to be in Simla,
yes. But
that is filmed in Penang.
Ah.
But all those houses, they are just used a little bit of it, because yes. They are restoring little bits of it.
Yes.
But they are gradually demolishing all the old houses.
Yes.
Because they're all in big gardens, and you can put a condominium there and house 2,000-3,000 people.
Mm. Well, also, interestingly, I used to live in a very old district of Hong Kong called Tin Hau. Tin Hau Miedo Sundong Fong Toi, which is a 1930s building, most beautiful, and my daughter's father is an architect, designed the interior. And we were only there 6 months when the landlady told us that she bought it at 1 million and sold it for 6 million to a property developer,
yeah. And
that we had to leave. And a few months before, Ang Lee came and filmed another part of Lust Caution in our street, because it was like old Shanghai.
Yeah.
And that's it, and it's all gone. So I just think there are parallels here to this whole idea not just of cities of the future and of preservation, but the preservation of a lifestyle that so many of us are losing. I think that's, it's not a tragedy, but it's certainly for me a nostalgia for a place which is perhaps perfectly at home nowhere, is an expression I've taken from a French feminist called Alain Cixous. She says that she weaves a magic carpet and she takes flight, but she's actually perfectly at home in the act of writing, which is now and here, not nowhere. And I think maybe now and here is where you are with your father, with his book. And two credits here, local architect Kenneth Yeo. Is Kenneth Y-E-O? Kenneth Yeo. He said he was full of praise for your father. He admired him because he had an evolution and evolving over time to accommodate extreme tropical climates, but also the growth of the buildings, which he feels gave Ypres a distinct character. That's what he says. And perhaps we can end our part of the conversation with your words about this beautiful book, that not only being a tribute to the love of your father, but a love for your country. You've had a lot of joy in Ypres and a lot of sorrow, but you were happy. So thank you very much, Ruth, for sharing with us.
A question before we go to the other room, and Ruth's already signed some books, fortunately, to give herself a little bit of rest, and really appreciate it when you've had, you know, a sort of cough and cold. But anyone want to ask any other question? Yes, thank you, Jen.
Following on from the question about listing.
Sorry, could we just get the microphone so people can hear at the back? Thank you.
Following on from the question about listing of buildings, and given that parts of Ypres are subject to flooding, did you come across anything in your research about planning regulations and whether your father had to fulfil any? He was just free to design anything anywhere, was he?
I have tried to find things at the archives in Ypres, anywhere, about his plans, so I could see, sort of, you go, but there's nothing. Everything has been destroyed. There's no plans. I wrote to the National Archives in Kuala Lumpur to find out anything about him. They'd never heard of him. He had lived there for 40 years, and he was the most prolific architect. There's nothing about him. So there's nothing. The planning department of nothing. I met one of his apprentices in Penang, and he ended up in a council office where they looked out in the archives. And I said, "Oh, can you show me where there are some archives?" He said, when the shelf was full, they threw the oldest ones away. I mean, that sadly is Malaysia. Very sad.
Thank you. Ruth, you make me feel terribly homesick by seeing all those old photographs. So I'm not sure whether to be grateful or not, but it's beautiful. But I also feel a lot of melancholy in your presentation. And I'm not sure why that is, when it should be of joy in bringing out a book of a man and a dad who's done some incredible things. I know Pam sort of touched on the issue of heritage and listing. And I can understand the concerns of the younger generation of people in corporate culture, what it is that this thing stands in the way. I've been in the Eastern Hotel, and it was a terrible movie, inside and outside, I thought. So the question of actually listing everything or holding things in memory because of the past is probably sort of not in the current mood of the time. That's not something you came in. So I don't know how you feel about it. Do you think that, you know, everything should be kept? Or
not
should
sure.
be made to progress, and you know, and I can understand this in the attachment you have to what you that build. And I think there are some wonderful examples. Thank you. Just on the comment.
No, I certainly think there has to be progress, and they have to build new, but they have to do it. They have to build beautiful things, and that's what they do not do. It's hideous. And it is just, they have to have in an old street, in an old town, they can't just tear it all down. As I say, tourism plays a great part in the country, but they don't have to make it sort of, in Penang, for instance, everything has become boutique hotels, and there are, all the house prices are going up, so the local people can't live there anymore. They are put into these high-rise blocks, and they're not happy there. I think definitely, if Malaysia, which has a very difficult climate, if they could maintain their buildings, but they let everything crumble.
Does anybody want to add to that, of their own experience, somewhere similar, or? Okay, maybe one more question, or have we?
But it's a wonderful country, and I think you should all go and visit.
Okay, well, I think that's very timely to say. It's been a wonderful chatting to you.